Okay, on to item five, presentation from staff and parametric. Tim.
So we have the first of a series of discussions we anticipate having with the board about the risk diversifying portfolio here today. And you recall, risk diversifying is a portion of the diversifying sub-portfolio that we really intend to be kind of the hedge to the equity portfolio. And the reason we have a dedicated portfolio outside of today is largely to accommodate the large illiquid allocation within our growth portfolio. So when we have a equity market drawdown, we talked about there not being a lot of volatility in the market over the past 5 years. History would indicate that that's probably unlikely to continue for the next 5 years. So when we have an equity market drawdown, we want to be able to rebalance easily and to buy equities for the long term when they're cheap. When they're cheaper, they're more attractive, and that's where we want to be swooping in. The diversifying sub-portfolio is really intended to be the offsetting portfolio to equities that when the equity market draws down, we can sell some of these securities that have not sold off as much and come into the equity markets and rebalance and maintain our long-term growth exposure. So you'll recall about a year ago, we came in front of the board and said we wanted to go test the market for risk diversifying strategies. Now, this is something that's a little bit different than what we've done in the past, given that we define risk diversifying by its behaviors, not by an asset class. So there's not a risk diversifying mutual fund. There's not a risk diversifying ETF that we can just go out and buy. What we're doing is saying we want to find three attributes in aggregate. One is the low correlation to the equity markets. Two is a positive rate of return in a quote-unquote normal market environment. That's probably the loosest piece of the definition there, but we want to not be paying insurance premiums along the way. And lastly, we need this to be highly liquid when there's equity market stress. We want to be able to sell this to buy the cheap stocks. If we're locked out of something, it really hasn't fulfilled its core role for us. We conducted an RFI last June, spent the latter half of 2017 really testing a lot of these strategies. Got a good response to that. Got about 33 responses across a lot of different types of implementation. Narrowed it down to a handful of strategies we thought were systematic, had behaviors we understood, either had a zero correlation to the equity markets or a negative correlation to the equity markets. Historically speaking, we can't count on that prospectively, but historically there was kind of an economic rationale for that. And narrowed it down to the first strategy that we're proposing today, which is Parametric's defensive equity. And I'll get to a little bit of a description about what defensive equity is in particular, but I want to talk about the broader structure of the diversifying portfolio that we're recommending first. So we have a mandate from the board in last year's asset allocation review that of this 12% in diversifying strategies, 3% was targeted to U.S. Treasuries. That's a role currently being fulfilled by AFL-CIO. 4% was targeted to broadly what we're talking about today. Wellington was a placeholder in that 4% allocation, and we're recommending Parametric come in to help fulfill that 4% allocation. And then 5% was targeted to risk parity, and that's a conversation we're deferring until next month. But right now it's a little bit of a balancing act. We want to maintain that AFL-CIO exposure and take Wellington down a bit and bring Parametric in to better diversify that. We anticipate this being, as I said, the first conversation of several conversations this year. We're maintaining an active dialogue with a couple of the strategies we thought were promising but weren't quite convinced yet that they were going to be applicable to Cicera, primarily because they hadn't been tested through a volatile market. We're starting to see the volatility come back in the market. We'll see them tested this year. That'll give us a better data set to test whether these are good for Cicera or a flash in the pan. And these largely fall into the alternative risk premia category, but that's a conversation for later this year. So let's talk a little bit about what defensive equity is and why we think it's going to be good for Cicera. Defensive equity is basically an insurance selling strategy, and this is a strategy where they sell puts, they sell calls on an equity index. By selling puts and calls both, we maintain, we're collecting the insurance premiums associated with those options, while not necessarily maintaining any type of equity allocation. So it's just the insurance premiums we're hoping to harvest there. By doing that, and we have the back-tested numbers in here, it ends up with a relatively low correlation to the equity markets. So great, we've satisfied, you know, objective number one. It has a modest expected rate of return. They talk about a 5 to 6% expected rate of return. What's been manifested with the low volatility in the markets has been less than that, but it's been positive. And the high liquidity in periods of market stress. Now, this is something where defensive equity is a little bit unique in that by selling puts and selling calls, we have exposure to other people. We have exposure to the, if the market moves against us, you know, we're selling an insurance premium. So they can be put against us or something can be called from us. The way Parametric approaches this is they sell puts and calls at what's called, they're well out of the money. They expect that there's an 80% likelihood that each one of these will expire unused. So like an insurance company, you're collecting your premiums along the way, not expecting to pay out on every insurance policy. But while we're doing that, we're maintaining treasury exposure that covers all of the notional exposure of the insurance contract. So we're selling a notional exposure of $100 of puts, $100 calls, we're keeping $100 in treasury collateral. So that if we need to redeploy the capital, the money is in treasury collateral and we can easily pull that down, not renew contracts. These contracts roll about 3 contracts per week. So you're constantly refreshing these and we can easily say pause, don't issue new contracts. We're going to draw down some of the collateral here and reallocate that into the equity market. So we think the liquidity profile is somewhat unique relative to their peer set.
So is this like a margin account? I'm just trying to understand the concept. So we're the treasury equities are the collateral for the puts and calls.
Yeah. Action, so the right? Puts and calls weren't going to be marked to market. So we're going to have the collateral pool there. So let's say we sell puts, we sell calls, and the market trends down. Well, now the puts are more valuable. And we have to maintain a margin account there. Now, we only have to maintain about 20% of the notional exposure. We're actually maintaining 100% of the notional exposure here. So as we move forward and, you know, let's say the equity market pulls back 20% and some of these puts are now in the money, meaning they can be executed, somebody can say to us, you wrote us that insurance policy that the market wouldn't drop more than 20%. The market did drop more than 20%. We would now like to make good on that contract. We can't just sit here and have a promissory note to them. We actually have to have a fund collateral pool. So we fund this collateral pool in U.S. Treasuries. And, you know, there's portion. So if the market is trending down and the puts are becoming more valuable, more of that collateral pool is going to have to be dedicated to paying out that portion there. The remainder of the collateral pool is free to be redeployed. We don't have to have it fully funded. So let's say there's a scenario where the equity market pulls back 20%. Well, we know a lot of the calls are going to expire worthless, so we can collect the insurance premium there. But the puts are going to be more valuable. So a portion of our collateral pool is going to have to be dedicated to that. But we can take up the remainder of that collateral pool, and we have flexibility there. It can maintain it in treasuries. We can let, you know, additional contracts roll off and free up that collateral pool. We could theoretically redeploy that directly into the equity markets and experience the rebound there. We've got a lot of flexibility about how we maintain this, but on a basic normal market environment, we would anticipate this being fully funded. So the collateral pool sitting there at $100, fully matching the collateral of both puts and calls, but we have flexibility about how to deploy that when and if we need to redeploy it.
This is probably a dumb question, but is this trading completely algorithm-based? I mean, is this all automated? Is this all modeled and
this is
executed?
This is largely model-driven. There's always a human on top of it, but this is a model that says we want to write these. We want to put the strike price at a point where we think there's an 80% likelihood it's going to expire unused. So the algorithm helps to set that strike price. So if the S&P 500 is at 2,500, then you might want to set the strike price at 2,400 and say, you know, based upon where market volatility is, based upon historical measures, we think this is going to expire unused.
So the model itself has the probabilistic outcome built into the number,
yes.
Buy, sell number.
And we have Parametric here. If we're going to go down the what does the algorithm do route, I'm going to defer that to Parametric.
No, I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. I'm never going to fully understand this, obviously. I'm just trying to get the basics. I know Jerry will understand.
No. I'm not. You've got Bitcoin down. I know you're going to be able to explain this.
So right. I appreciate the explanation. I'm just trying to get my arms around it so I can at least speak.
No, but there's a model that's going to guide where that price is set, and then you sell the contract to the market on an exchange-traded basis. So we're not necessarily taking direct counterparty risk. These are exchange-cleared.
Of all we do, this is the least I'm knowledgeable of. This is probably the most confusing for me.
And it gets complicated, but I think with the top level, if we think about it as we are selling insurance to the market, we're collecting the insurance premiums. Right. So, largely speaking, if you think about a large insurance company, a State Farm, how do they make their money? They collect the insurance premiums, they invest the float, they invest the excess, and you hope to pay out less than you take in based upon your models, your underwriting, that sort of thing. It's the same basic concept here. The models are helping set the strike price. The underwriting is understanding the volatility that's in the market at a point in time, and you're constantly resetting these. Like, I think it's 12 times per month you're resetting these contracts. So you're capturing near-term volatility, moving your prices around, and collecting that insurance premium over time.
How close are you and your staff going to be monitoring this? I mean, this is so, to me, it's all new, so.
Yeah. So this would be built on, so Parametric, we have an existing relationship with based upon their overlay of our cash strategy.
Right.
This would largely be accretive to that. So the type of oversight we have on the overlay, this will sit right beside that so we can see them in parallel there. And this is, we're getting daily reporting. We're monitoring closely on a monthly basis.
And this is the first time, correct me if I'm wrong, that we're talking about getting into the options business, right? I mean, and so, right?
No, our overlay strategy is using options as well.
Is using options,
okay. Yeah.
It's as close as I've heard us getting into the puts and calls business, which, so it must, the rest of the stuff must be behind the curtains a little bit more than this is.
Well, it's the overlay strategy is more on the future side.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, in words I can understand, so they have to be very small, how do we mark to market in a strategy like this? How do we, at some point, we put a stick in the ground and say, it's worth this today.
Yep.
And how do we value that?
So the puts and calls are based on 3-month forward contracts. So there's a strike price, there's a current market price, there's a strike price for the contract to be executed. As market moves away from that, let's just talk about the puts so somebody can put against us if the market falls.
Mm-hmm.
As the current price of the market moves up, this becomes less valuable. You're further out of the money. As it moves down, it becomes more valuable. You're closer to being in the money. There is a specific methodology that says, this difference, this movement here between the current price of the market and the strike price translates out to a collateral balance that we need to see over there. And that's just a very mechanical process. The exact formula, the portfolio manager's here, let him give that to you. But
so when they appear on this page, when Ed's giving the next report and it says Parametric and it says 12/31, whatever it is, or end of 3 months or something, what have they measured? What goes into that figure? Don't get into anything that you're not supposed to.
Price movements.
Price movements.
Yeah. So you're going to have the value of the puts and of the calls, the value of the insurance premium minus anything you've paid out. That's really what this is. We're going to bring in the insurance premiums about 50 basis points per month. They aim to keep about half of that. Gets you to the 5 to 6% per year. That's what they're hoping to maintain, that insurance premium minus anything they've had to pay out in terms of a put or a call being in the money.
Is there a benchmark for this kind of
That's
strategy?
The difficult part. There's really not. It's an absolute return benchmark. So it's a positive expected rate of return. These is, again, going back to the larger challenge of all of the diversifying strategies. They're not benchmark defined. They're behavior defined. In this case, we're talking about a positive expected rate of return. And we expect to see that in most market environments. There are, you know, two market environments where this strategy doesn't work, and that's when you don't have volatility. It tends not to work as well. Also, when you have direct, well, so if you have a market that's just trending up like January, it's kind of on a single trajectory there without a lot of variability. Well, okay, that's not going to work because the calls are going to be in the money, and they're going to be, you know, people are going to be putting insurance claims against you. You're going to be out of, you're going to be losing some capital in that environment. And extreme shocks. Well, then the puts are going to be put against you. But if you have volatility in the marketplace, then you have, if there's volatility, you're going to be able to collect the insurance premiums, really because there's a behavioral reason for people to want the insurance premiums or to pay the insurance premiums, because losing money hurts. There's economic reasons.
Just a minute, I want to write that down.
Yeah. Good bumper sticker.
Tim, as I think about this, you've got puts. Obviously, as the market declines, puts get more valuable. As the market goes up, the calls get more valuable.
Yes.
You've got a portfolio of each that you're buying. And riding against one another. What it strikes me as being like is a casino, where you're, think of it as blackjack only, and the house has got a 2 or 3% margin.
Could you use another analogy?
I sort of wanted to get your reaction to that. That it's a fairly ought to be a fairly stable net result.
Yeah. While I would like to disagree with the casino analogy, if you're characterizing us as the house, I would agree that that is an apt analogy. That there is a structural reason for us to, you know, collect that consistent premium. It won't be, you know, there every single month, every single quarter, but there is a economic rationale for us to be able to collect that insurance premium.
And there's a very real history of these in action.
Yes.
That we can look at and have some comfort that going forward we can realize the same kind of returns.
Which leads to my last question. There's a pretty impressive list of clients in there in Parametrics. And are they all into this product, or are they into different products?
I think that's across the entire lineup of Parametric strategies, not just specific to the.
So what experience can they point to with their clients specific to this product with the last 1 year, 2 year, 3 years experience on average?
Yeah. So in the volatility risk premium, which is, you know, what they're proposing for us is a custom strategy, but in this suite of products here, I know Sonoma County has been engaged in this, a derivative of this strategy for the past several years. Houston has been, and I've talked with a number of their clients. And beyond that, I'd be stretching my memory banks to say who else was in it. But
so, how about what has Sonoma's experience been with the product, if you know?
It's a briefer history there, and so they've been exposed when there hasn't been a lot of market volatility. So, I would say in terms of how we intend to use it, their experience is probably not directly applicable.
So, at the risk of using another term that I know we don't like to associate with what we do, but I was trying to understand this concept in reading this, you know, packet material, and I thought about the role of the bookie in the concept of the opposite sides of the line, right? And is there any rough analogy that this is the vigorish, that the strategy here is to make it on the vig and not be on either side of the bet?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I can understand it in those terms.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So your next report, if you
gambling and custom market. Yeah.
The minutes of this meeting are going to be interesting. Yes.
See, I thought State Farm was going to be the good analogy. I didn't want to go down the book.
Well, and route. I think that John makes a good point. This isn't something that just, you know, came about January of 2018 or something. I mean, it's been around for a while. It's right. Not. You know, I mean, it's a slightly different for us to be getting into this, but it's not, you know, it's somewhat of a known quantity.
We're not the guinea pigs.
We're not the guinea pigs in this.
Right.
And I think that the big difference has to do with managers, and their success is largely, I think, depending on the models that they're utilizing with all of this. And I think that, you know, Verus has also taken a look at Parametric. And maybe, Ed, if you could speak for a minute about Verus's stance on this allocation.
Yeah. We've looked at the strategy. I've met with them and had a chance to go over the book and ask all of my questions about it, so everything ties up there. I think the key issue in terms of thinking about options is, or an easy construct is to think about payoff diagrams. Seeing a payoff diagram just makes a lot of sense very quickly because we're capturing the middle part of that. Permit me to, and I could go to the whiteboard and draw this in like 20 seconds. I think it would hit home on a lot of stuff. So the idea here is that this blue line represents the payoff that you get from owning a call if the stock finishes wherever the stock finishes. So the stock price, you invest in the S&P 500 and you buy an option to buy the S&P 500 at a certain strike price. We'll call that X. So you bet in today's environment, the S&P 500 is like 2,700, and you say, okay, I want to buy the right to buy the S&P 500 with this call option. And if today the market is at 2,700, then this option is only worth something to me if it goes up. And so wherever up is, that's where I make profit. The amount of profit I make is based on my cost. I have to spend something on that option. So if I buy the option for some cost, at today's market value, and I make money as long as the value of the S&P 500 covers my cost. So if my cost is 100, and if the S&P 500 is at 2,700, I only make money if the market goes up above 2,800. That's where I start getting into the goods. Okay. Everybody's with me so far? Great. Let's carry the same analogy through. Same basic concept. I think the market's going to go down. I would like to buy an option that allows me to sell the market if it goes down. We're currently at 2,700. My put option cost me 100. If the market goes down by, in this case, X minus C, market goes down to 2,600, I break even. If it goes down below that, I make money. The option, the put allows me to sell something worth 2,700 for 2,200 or something, and I make money off of that. That's owning a put, and that's owning a call. So that's easy enough. But what we're talking about with this strategy is the other side of that trade, where we're going to sell it. And so when we sell this, this is as if we were buying the call. If we sell it, we flip this on the x-axis. Now we say, okay, well, I'm going to collect the premium, but the market is going to look like this. So here's my strike price of X. Here's the premium I'm going to collect, C. And as long as I'm okay in here, at X plus C, I make money. Here's where I start to lose money. So on my call option, if the market rallies significantly and I sold my call option, I collected my premium, like the insurance company, but now if the market's way down here, I don't do so well. The market is now capturing that away from me. Similarly on the put, if I flip this chart about the x-axis, then I have this. So again, make money all through here, collecting my premium. If the market goes down, this is where I lose the money. Here's my C. Now, the art of it is to say, where is that 80%? Can I capture market data to tell me about these fluctuations? Because I want to live in here, and I want to live in here. This is the good zone. I want to live there. If I live there 80% of the time, I'm great. If I'm wrong and the market tanks dramatically, then we get into our collateral. And do we have the collateral to cover it? The strategy does, so we're okay there. Here, we have the collateral as well, so that helps. But also, if the market is rallying, A, we're doing really well on the rest of our portfolio, so that's good news. B, as this gets really big, this means the market is really running away from us in a big way. That doesn't happen a lot. I mean, even last year, when we think about like a 20% kind of rally or 30% kind of rally, the loss here would be really minimal. So it would take a gigantic upmarket for this to become unprofitable. But this is where it happens. This is where the market, or where the strategy doesn't do well, when we get out into this space, or when we have a significant sell-off in that space. And that's essentially what we dealt with in the beginning of February. The market sold off pretty significantly, and the puts got out. So this is
which markets are we going to be investing in? Which markets?
So we'll be writing puts and calls on the S&P 500.
Domestic equities.
Yeah. Largest, most liquid market.
Strictly on?
Yeah,
strictly.
These are exchange. So these are the standard plain vanilla contracts.
Okay.
Part of how they mitigate risk here is that they're short-term contracts, and so they expire. And so try to collect the premium, and then it goes away. So don't lock into a one-year leap or anything like that. Keep it like a month.
Why do they choose the S&P 500 as opposed to others?
Just because it is the largest, oldest, most liquid market out there. Transaction costs are the lowest. Counterparties are readily available there. So it is the granddaddy of all these markets.
They can actually trade it multiple times throughout the week, too. So the options markets and expiration dates are a key component here. So being able to set an expiration date of plus 1 month, and when those options are created and when you can buy and sell them, you want to have liquid markets so you can get in and out of them. And the U.S. market is the deepest and most frequent on those dynamics, too.
So they're actually writing contracts Monday, Wednesday, Friday, every week. So, so you'll have a basket that's just offset by a little bit. So we do get into the negative areas, the territory there. It's 1/12 of the portfolio might be exposed to that, and then you're writing a new contract that would have different strike prices.
And is it the entire S&P 500?
It is.
Yes. So it is the price movement on the S&P 500 that affects where on this line we are. So no individual stocks are traded here. This is a contract based upon price movement of the entire basket.
And so is there like a person group that looking at thing, I think the S&P is going to do X. Is that how it is? They think it's going to go up, it's going to go down, they're doing this?
Yeah, and so you'll have the counterparties who say, you know, either I believe the market's going to go down and I want to buy insurance. Well, what does insurance cost me? Who's offering me a contract at various points? And you could buy a let's say the market was at 2,700 today, and you wanted to buy a contract at 2,600. Well, you might say that's too expensive. That cost me 150. Right. So you can kind of price, you can shop for your price point there. Parametric is going to come in and say, we'll offer that contract at the 80% likelihood that it's going to, from their perspective, that it's going to expire out of the money. And then offer that to the exchange. The exchange would, you know, make that market with the counterparty there.
What's the fee structure like for doing that?
For the actual...
Yeah, I mean, for them to go out and use the exchange, and what does the exchange charge?
Well, the pricing is going to vary depending upon market volatility. So when the markets get more highly volatile, you're charging a higher insurance premium. It's like selling insurance after a fire.
Fire, right, okay.
If there hasn't been a fire in 20 years, your insurance premiums are going to be lower. If there's been a fire lately, your insurance premiums are going to be higher. So it varies over time.
Makes sense.
Tim, you said there's a problem with a benchmark. I guess it's non-existent. So let's assume there's no benchmark. And I think I heard you say this would be a customized product for Sarah. So how do we gauge success? What will it look like when we get there?
Yeah. We're going to be looking for a positive rate of return.
So anything like 1%, 2%, 3%, what's victory look like?
The target is a 5 to 6% positive expected rate of return, although that's going to vary significantly depending on volatility levels in the marketplace. If the VIX is coming in at 8, it's kind of hard to charge a premium that's going to cover that. If the VIX is coming in at 30, premiums are abundant in the marketplace there. So that's going to time vary, but 5 to 6% over a long period of time is the stated goal.
Okay.
Importantly for us, it's the correlation measures to our broad equity exposure, and critically, it's the liquidity measures, and those will something we'll be testing on a regular basis. So there, it's going to be a multi, you know, what does success look like? It's going to be multifaceted. We have to be not paying money for this. We have to be generating a modest rate of return. We need to see that this is behaving differently than the equity markets. So that if the equity markets are legging down 20% and we want to be buyers of stocks, this needs to be, you know, flat or up or down insignificantly. And we need to see that the liquidity is there, that we can redeploy this capital in a period of market stress. And that's where I was talking about with the collateral pool. That gives us some comfort that the excess collateral can be redeployed at very low cost.
And what makes this unique for Cicera? How is it customized for us?
What's customized for us is the degree of, is basically taking all the equity exposure out. I think a lot of their other strategies leave some equity exposure in, have a net long position. Some of them would be, in round numbers, 50 calls, 50 puts, 100 in collateral. This is 100, 100, 100. There's various flavors of how funded the collateral pool is and how much net long position they have.
That's actually an interesting question, Jerry. I don't think Tim and I compared notes on that. My discussions with Parametric led me to believe probably a 3-4% kind of absolute return. The back testing I saw had surprisingly nice, consistent positive returns, several months of negative returns, but
yeah.
I guess somewhat lower than what.
So 3 or 4, is that net of fees? Or
yes.
Net of fees.
Yeah. And I think there is a stated 5-6. I think a 3-4% would probably be a realistic number.
You said we have to keep, you said 100, 100, 100. We have to keep some money available, right?
Right.
That money, if you were doing this program, where would that money be placed?
If we weren't
doing the paramedic.
So will we, my right now, we have an underweight position in our risk diversifying allocation, like so it's largely exposed to equities as we draw down equities to fund this up. So whether it's this strategy or any other strategy in the risk diversifying category, we're the phase 2B allocations, which we're currently operating under, have a higher equity allocation than what we want to get to long term. We know we need to pull down our equity exposure and build up the risk diversifying exposure in order to be at the trustee stated long-term asset allocation goals.
Any other questions?
Are there other products, I guess, that would fill this particular strategy or something similar to this strategy? Because we're kind of, I think we're being asked to kind of bet the farm, if you will, that $200 million on a strategy that's got some question marks around it. Should we consider splitting that between this and another strategy, or does it make more sense to have it all in one strategy?
So we'd be, of that 4% allocation to risk diversifying strategies, we would be leaving an allocation within with Wellington and bringing this in. So
I'm sorry,
we'd actually be adding to the diversification.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I meant that leg of the stool.
Yeah.
Would it be better to have four legs of a stool instead of three?
And that's where we want to continue to have the dialogue with a couple of other managers about some of the strategies, and we'd be potentially looking at bringing in two additional strategies over the remainder of the year. So the $200 million would be a starting point. We might be drawing down against that and having a more diversified program by year end. But right now, it's we want to get started on this. We look at this and say, this has got a good economic rationale behind it. It is a good offset to Wellington. It's expressing the behaviors we want to have in the risk diversifying strategy. So as a starting point, we're comfortable recommending the $200 million allocation to the defensive equity, and as we identify additional strategies over the remainder of the year, that number might come down into a more diversified program. So if we brought two more strategies in over the course of the year, maybe this is a $150 million allocation or $120 million allocation.
So you're saying there's no obligation, we're not like a set amount that we have to invest with them, or
No, this is open-ended. This is a separate account, so we're free to scale it up and down. This is not a limited partnership where we're committing funds and it's a set it and walk away for 10 years, wait for the money to come back. This is a highly liquid market, scaled up or scaled down.
So I guess I can see two ways then of at least two ways of approaching this. One is to go the $200 million on a, I mean, it's not a flyer. I certainly want to give you guys credit for having done a lot of the due diligence. And then peeling off some of that later on if we bring in some additional vehicles that we want to use. Yeah. Or another possibility would be to half the commitment here, make it $100 million, and keep that other $100 million dry as we look for those other strategies rather than have to peel it out at a later date. Would that make any sense?
I mean, certainly, I mean, that's a viable route here. The challenge there is we spend more time with excess funds in the equity market. So let's step back here. We have a long-term goal of drawing down the equity allocation, building up this diversifying allocation. If we can move more rapidly, we get to the board's stated asset allocation goal more quickly. If we take the approach of just legging in methodically here, we're going to spend more time as an organization with a higher equity allocation. Now, that's a board-level decision. If that's something the board's comfortable with, we can certainly pursue that, but that is not in keeping with the long-term stated asset allocation goals as they stand today.
Okay. Good, good
so
question.
There's a tracking error element there.
Question is, why did you choose $200 million? Not that I'm against it, just so.
Yeah. It was, we felt like $200 million was the an appropriate measure to get us overall closer to our goal. This is still not getting us to our 12% allocation,
right,
but we're starting to fill out that 4% in these types of strategies here. So we took a look at that, tested it on a, everything you see in our memo basically does a back-tested pro forma, basically saying if we had this in there at this allocation, then we start to see an overall expected rate of return that we think is attractive with AFL-CIO and Wellington in the mix. Importantly, the correlation matrix was powerful at that number. We tested it at various levels. We were most comfortable at the $200 million level in terms of its contribution to the overall diversifying program.
Any other questions for Tim before? So why don't we take a short 5-minute break while you bring in our guests?
Sounds good.
Okay. I know you're good.